This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox joins us now in studio to, for the first time, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So love it when I butcher your name the first time you come in for a visit. Hope that doesn't set the tone for the whole conversation.
No, no worries.
It's great to have you here. And I'll tell you right up front, you know, there are several subjects that we want to talk to you about, but we really, the goal here is to understand how you think about the job as police commissioner and how you're bringing that philosophy into how you're addressing both the needs and the issues inside the department, in the city. So it's a pleasure to have you here. I am going to take you back a year, and I'm going to start with a little bit of sound that, with a voice that you are going to recognize. Here we are.
To come home and be able to lead in this department, in this city, to come to a place where I grew up, where I was raised, where I was an officer, where I raised my family, this is an incredible opportunity. And with all great opportunities comes great responsibility. And I look forward to making sure I live up to that responsibility.
1 year and 1 month ago, you become commissioner. Is it the job you thought it was going to be?
This is an honorable job. It is more than what I thought it would be. It is not the easiest job in the world, but the fact is there's just so much responsibility involved. And you know, this city is a wonderful city. I'm from here, and every time I have a conversation with someone in the community, and they cheer me on and say, you know, we appreciate what you're doing and what the department is doing, it gives me all the energy and fuel I need to deal with whatever the next issue or problem of the day is. And so I'm so appreciative of that. It's an honorable job, and I'm just privileged to have this position. So I have no right to ever even think about complaining about this job in any way.
So when you say more than, let's take both sides of that, right? And let's start with the positive. More than, as in extra. What is more than you hoped for about the job?
So I guess part of my personality is that I don't mind challenges. In this job at this time, in law enforcement in general, it has so many challenges right now that if I ever cared about wanting to make a difference, you know, this is the era to be in, and there's a lot going on. And so, you know, personally, if you feel as though you want to give back, if you want to do something, I've kind of spent a great portion of my adult life, you know, preparing to lead, even though I didn't realize I was doing that, to maybe try to make a difference in a field that's so important to the world, law enforcement in general, and what we do around public safety. And so the opportunity to come and lead in this department at this time with all the things going on, it's just, it keeps me busy and it helps me stay focused. Absolutely helps me stay focused. And so, you know, that's what I mean about when I say that. There's many challenges that I'm trying to address in a priority way, in a way in which we have to focus on one thing at a time. But the fact is we're trying to get to them all, and time is going by very quickly. That year went by very, very quickly, and maybe the years to come will go by even quicker. But, you know, I am more actually just excited about the people that I lead. I'm more excited about the city we live in. I'm really excited about the mayor we have and her leadership, and the combination of you know, coming together and partnering with all the people that we're trying to partner with to address the needs of the city, the needs of our employees, the needs of you know, of everyone in general, our mental health across the board. Yeah, it just keeps me busy and focused, and I actually enjoy it.
So, you know, you said it's a harder job than you thought, and I would have just said, okay, tell me what's harder. But since you said, you know, you're focused on a set of challenges, give me the top three or four. You're a year in now. Yeah. Right now, when you look at sort of your landscape of the stuff you must pay attention to, and you said, if I ever wanted to make a difference, if I ever wanted to make change. So what are those three or four challenges you most need to make a difference on, need to make change on, as the commissioner of the Boston Police Department right now?
Starting off, probably perception of the police and understanding of what we are and what we do and the people who do the work. There is a recruitment challenge that we're having, but it's not just a police challenge. It's a worldwide challenge around finding people to do jobs. So we're competing with everyone right now, unlike any other time before, except we're coming off of a period where, certainly there might be some bias against policing as a result of some poor policing in the past that was played over and over and over again during, COVID and during the, seriously the protest period. Rightfully so around the issues of the time. But the fact is that unlike any other time before, there was nothing on TV. There was no sports. There was no TV shows. And they were showing over and over again images of, certain officers in a few cities abusing people, violating the laws.
Was there poor policing in Boston?
I'm sure that there was. And absolutely, there's probably been in the past. But the point is that what I'm trying to say is that unlike any other period, the world kind of shut down, and that was the only thing on TV. And that was the only thing that people saw. And not only did they see it, their children saw it, and there were protests. And the fact is that, there was a lot going on, but there seems to be that the focus of a lot of people and united a lot of people in a lot of ways, but it was around, police and police abuse around some of this. And that within itself has a way of helping people, well, not helping, but causes biases as a result. And so now we've come out of that period a little bit. But the fact is that unlike any other period, there's a lot of young people that were exposed to, certainly or made aware of, one, that abuse does happen. But by the way, it happens in all fields across the board. Policing doesn't just only, have ownership in, poor policing or at least poor doing, ability to do their job. But the reality is people saw this, young people saw this. And that's part of who we recruit in to come on this job, right? You want to give back to the world. You want to be, you want to give back to society. You want to help. This job is a service job around that. But now there's a lot of people who don't want to be associated with it just because of the imagery involved with certainly this period.
So we're going to stay here for a minute. So first, mm-hmm. we're with Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox here. I asked you for a list. You gave me the first item on the list, which was perception and recruitment. And I'm now not even going to let you finish the list. We'll come back to it later. Because since you went here, I want to stay here for a minute. Thanks. And you've talked about young people. You've talked about, the national outcry against police violence, police abuse, mm-hmm. anti-black police violence, racism over the last couple of years. I have a couple of questions. One is a very practical question. Since you talked about recruitment, how many officers do you have right now on the force? And how many open positions? Do you know even by order of magnitude or roughly?
Yeah. So, we are probably somewhere around the 1700 range. And I think we're approved for probably around 2287, somewhere around that number. But that number fluctuates because people retire. They can retire almost any day of the week. And then hopefully in next month, the end of the month, we'll have a recruit class of at least 130 or so officers that'll join our force. However, usually around January, there's another group of people who tend to retire. And we don't know what that number is until the individuals decide for themselves if they're going to do that. So our number is, decreasing. And then we have a fair number of people or a certain number of people that may be about injured as a result of getting hurt while they're working. So they're not eligible to be out working. So our numbers are nowhere near as robust as what they've been in the past. But we're trying to come up with inventive ways to address that, just by making sure that all of our units participate in increasing our numbers. In our specialized units, we've had a rotation period where they come back to the force, similar to how the National Guard or some of the military calls units back.
Yeah, and so to help our listeners understand this, you decided to do this recently. So if somebody's mm-hmm. in like a special group, a special unit, you're actually having them come back and spend, I think it's 20 shifts,
tours,
is that
yes.
right,
tours?
Yeah. On regular patrol, basically.
Which is about a month.
In order to relieve the pressure on patrol forces, is that correct?
Correct. I mean, Boston is a pretty major city. We have a lot of specialized units that do special things, and they're very good at what they do.
You served in special units.
I did at one point, absolutely. And but the reality is that when your force gets diminished over time, sometimes a lot of departments revert back to what they were before and get rid of all specialized units and just go to the basic unit of our patrol force around that. But those units are very, very important because whether it's the our anti-gang violence unit or the homicides units or all these different units that we have, that they're all considered special, do really important work, and they're very, very good at what they do because that's they can specialize in that. And so we don't want to deplete those. We just want to contribute to help out with the larger force, and that's what we're trying to do. To be inventive around addressing some of our staffing issues.
So you've talked about recruitment. You've talked about the need to appeal to young people and the fact that young people may well be quite turned off to law enforcement. You've also praised the mayor. The mayor's been super clear here on the show. She'll be here again a week from Monday, that reform is top priority. In fact, she said in a radio interview earlier this week, she won't sign a police contract that doesn't include the reforms that are important to her, even intimated that if the police contract comes out of arbitration and she doesn't love what she sees, she could conceivably not bring it to the Boston City Council. How important are getting those reforms done to being able to recruit new people whose view of law enforcement has been colored by what you just talked about in these last 3 years?
So they are important, certainly in contractual, because in the end, this is a highly unionized environment, and contractually there are some things in there that make it difficult to, I want to say reform, but that word, it's a little charged, reform. The reality is this, you want to understand how I look at things? I look at things in a sense that, they are best practices, and when you run something, you should run it well, and it doesn't matter what the industries are. And so there are things that we can do and I'm trying to do and that we will continue to do to make us be a well-run organization. If we are a well-run organization, well-supervised organization with strong policies, strong procedures, strong training protocols in general, and that we actually follow up on what we say we're going to do and we check to make sure that we're doing what we're supposed to do, more than likely we will be a very, very good police department.
So give me an example, please.
Oh, and so I'll give you an example. You look across the country and you see these incidents of, sometimes police abuse that happens. Very rarely when it happens do you look out there and say, well, oh my gosh, they need to create a policy to tell people not to do that. Well, police departments have tons of rules. We have hundreds, if not thousands of rules. The rules are already there. The issue are the officers following it? Do they understand what they are? Do we routinely make sure that they not only understand what they're supposed to do, but we check to make sure that they're doing it? Do we praise them for when they're doing it? Do we discipline and hold them accountable when they don't? If you do these things pretty routinely, and it's a part of what you do, for the most part, you have a professional organization that doesn't routinely have issues like that.
Commissioner, how do you know that your officers know you're really serious about this?
I don't know if they know it, but I do know this. I'm serious about it, so our supervisors will understand that. One part of what we're doing is we're trying to become nationally accredited on that. So when you have an independent agency come in to check to see, are we following our own rules and all our own regulations around that? And so we're preparing, for that accreditation now by starting to look at our own policies and rules and procedures around that. And it's also on what we emphasize on a daily basis. You praise the behavior that you look for, and then you hold people accountable when they don't, or at least they do behavior that you don't. And that's what we absolutely try to do. We started off when I started talking about that national narrative and trying to undo biases. Well, one of the things that have come out of that, unlike other industries, when was the last time you heard a news agency or someone said that, X is a good department, Boston's a good department, New York, L.A., it doesn't matter. It's just like there's no model police departments anymore. It's like no one even will give credit to anyone who's actually doing the work. Well, the fact is that you have to, actually acknowledge and give credit due to people that actually are doing the work or trying to do the work in a good way. And this is part of some of the biases we talked about. They come up with a list every year, the best hospitals, the best schools, the best universities, the best place to invest your money. Do you ever hear that about police departments?
I take it it's your goal that if there were such a list,
that we would be at the top of the list. And there's things that you'd have to do, just like those agencies would have to do, to make that happen, right? Do you have strong protocols? Do you have strong procedures? Do you check it? You know, do you keep data on what you do? There's a whole bunch of things that you can do around that. And that is exactly what we're trying to do as a department, to not just, you know, talk the talk, but actually walk the walk around that and have data and things of that nature to prove it.
You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are here with Michael Cox, the commissioner of the Boston Police Department. So I am going to pick up a thread that you started just before we took a pause there, and we're gonna pivot with it. You said, nowhere in the country do you hear anybody say, you know, so-and-so's police department is great. Interestingly, recently, the editorial board of the Boston Globe praised the Boston Police Department for de-escalation techniques in working with large groups of youth, where there were some arrests with the large groups of youth who were, and you know, any word I use next, someone will find loaded. Unruly, violent, aggressive. And there have been a series of these incidents in downtown Boston, and we're talking large groups of youth. In a couple of cases, police officers have been assaulted. We've seen large groups of arrests. In particular, there was one evening where first, you know, at the movie theater, and then in another location, and we're talking, you know, teenagers. Two things. One, praise for the Boston Police Department for using de-escalation techniques even after an assault, at least not one officer. Two, you and the press conference exhorting parents saying, we're not babysitters. We need you to know where your kids are. Three, multiple occasions presented differently, also groups of drunken teenagers at festivals in the North End versus what's happening in downtown or Dorchester-Roxbury line. This is one where I really want to understand. You're a dad. I want to understand what you think is happening, what you think the police's job is, and how you think the police need to interact with the communities, including communities outside Boston, on this.
Well, that's a very tough question. And I'll say that, you know, certainly there's been a short string of large groups of kids, particularly at the end of the summer here, that have gathered and just acted in behaviors that were criminal, to be quite honest with you. When you start, you know, assaulting people, not just the police, but just regular folks that are just in the area for no reason at all, almost in a way like it's a game, that behavior is just not appropriate, and it's not, you know, it's not civil. It's actually criminal. But the point is, like, what is going on in, you know, in the world or in these kids' lives where they don't feel as though they're going to be held accountable for that behavior. And, you know, and maybe things have changed. When I was younger, you know, when you're in large groups of people, sometimes you can hide behind the group in general and feel as though you're invisible to the crowd around that. But the fact is, it's usually you're not out there doing that kind of behavior. But if you, it's not even just in Boston. If you look across the country, you know, the large groups of young people are going and doing things, whether it's malls and going through and robbing it and doing all kind of things. And we need to understand, you know, what is going on where people think it's okay and that they can get away with it. And we're the people in their lives to say, you know, what are you doing? You know, I don't know. When I was 12, I couldn't imagine me going out and being out in malls and doing things without my parents understanding where I am and what I'm doing and things of that nature. But, you know, I don't know if that's still a thing today. And maybe as a result of coming off this pandemic and the fact is that they've lost some years in school, even though they were in school, and, you know, maybe their maturation process hasn't caught up with them. But there's some issues there. And I know the city is doing a great deal, and this is where, you know, I appreciate the mayor and a great deal around this, is that trying to make sure that they get services to take away the excuses to, you know, around the behavior. Whatever services that they need, the mental health services, if it's food insecurity, if it's housing insecurity, if it's parental guidance on how to parent, you know, provide some services to the parents, to families or whatever, to let them know that this behavior is not okay. You know, and you know, they need to be held accountable around that. And you talked about reform. There's been a lot of reform around criminal justice. There's been a lot of reform around particularly dealing with youth and kids. And some of it, you know, rightly, deservedly should be changed around it. But if it gets to the point where some of them feel as though that they're not going to be held accountable at all and there's no consequence, I worry that the behavior could potentially get worse.
So this is a question that I want to ask you because this comes across this set of circumstances. This comes across philosophy at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard, where we have a complex crisis around addiction, homelessness, untreated mental health. Mayor Wu has been very clear repeatedly that her view is that is a public health problem. You do public health response first. You do criminal justice response second, right? Because, for example, we've had conversations here about tents and tarps are shelter, but they also shelter trafficking, human trafficking, drug trafficking, for example. As a commissioner of police, do you subscribe to services first, criminal justice response second? And can you subscribe to that philosophy as a police commissioner?
So, and maybe this gets to community policing around it, and I haven't talked much about that, but I believe that, you know, we have more laws on the books than we can ever enforce. We could probably, you know, arrest or for almost anything because there's so many laws out there. But we usually prioritize our ability or our resources around what the public wants in a particular area around that, right? And I think that's the focus of it. Certainly, the city has said that Mass and Cass, it's going to be a public health-led issue around that. And that's what we've been doing as a department in general. And we're there to support the people that work there and all the other resources around that to make sure that the people there get the help they need. However, when it starts to become a public safety issue, when people are being killed, when people are being shot or stabbed, when the people who work in the area don't feel comfortable walking in that area or actually participating in doing their job, then it starts to turn into something else. And that was the purpose of the city ordinance that is being proposed because, to be quite honest with you, it is, you know, now I'm seeing it as becoming more of a public safety issue around that. And then that's when, you know, we have to enforce laws. But we have to have the right laws to enforce around the tents and tarps that can hide behind that. Constitutionally, there's only so much we can do. When you put up a tent or whatever and you are calling that your home, you know, we need search warrants to go into people's homes. And now we get into a vague area. Like, do you need that with tents and tarps and whatever? And so one of the things we're not going to do is over-police. And so because we're not going to do that, we want clear laws to help us be able to address the crime issues around that. And the tents and tarps that are put up are become a public safety issue around that because, one, it's a public way. Two, it's you know, what goes on behind that is just, it's not healthy for the people who live there. It's not healthy for anyone.
I want to clarify for listeners just a couple of things. So Mayor Wu has brought to the city council an ordinance that would allow, after warning an opportunity to store your goods and an opportunity for transportation or some other form of housing, for tents and tarps to be removed immediately versus having to wait for 48 hours.
Yep.
The Boston City Council has waited and will do a hearing on it at the end of September. In the meantime, a subset of Boston City Councilors, again just this week, wrote a letter calling for the mayor to declare a state of emergency that they claim would allow for those tents and tarps to be removed without that ordinance being passed. Would you like to see that declaration of a state of emergency called if the city council is not going to pass the ordinance in quick order?
You know, I'm not going to, you know, probably comment on whether or not a declaration could be, but I do know this, is that, you know, when asked, you know, what tool would help around, you know, the issues around the tents and tarps, and we weighed in about an ordinance doing that, and it hasn't been taken up yet. But if it does, you know, that gives us the ability to enforce laws around that. It gives us the ability to prevent, I hate to say it, you know, the tents and tarps from popping up all over the city and in the behavior that's associated with, you know, what goes on behind that from happening all over the city. So it gives us a tool to be able to address it. And I'm not talking about homelessness or folks, who have substance abuse issues or mental health issues. You know, one is they're getting services, and we want to hopefully help them get services. It's for the other folks that are attracted to those groups to either take advantage of their mental health issues, to take advantage of the fact that they're, you know, they have substance abuse issues, to sell drugs, or to traffic, human traffic people around that. Some of the folks there are living a horrific life in some of those areas because of the people associated that surround those areas. And to be quite honest, it's not that easy to separate the two around that, particularly when you have tents and tarps. And so you remove that, it makes it far easier for us to enforce laws around that and help protect, the people that are there, the people, the residents are in the area. And so I guess the answer to your question is that, when it starts to become a public safety issue, then, you know, part of our job is to enforce laws. And so, I think I've approached that particularly around mass and cast. And we've certainly heard from the business community. We've heard from the residents that are around there. We've heard from some of the people who live in mass and cast about them not even feeling safe under the conditions that they're there.
One more question on this. And I am not asking this voyeuristically.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anyone in your own personal circle who's experienced the opioid addiction crisis?
I think it would be almost difficult in this day and age to not know someone who has. It's a horrible thing, drug addiction in general. So, yes, I am a little older, so I certainly have people that I know or have been in certainly am involved in our extended family that have struggled with that, yes.
We're with Michael Cox, who is the commissioner of the Boston Police Department here. There's one last sort of big area. And again, I said at the beginning, this is conversation. This is our first time getting to talk to you. Mm-hmm. I certainly hope that it won't be the last, and we're happy to have you here in Studio 2. We're trying to understand how you think about the job.
Mm-hmm.
And using these large issues that are happening in the city right now to understand that. So here is the last one. We have had a series of shootings. The most high profile of late were the 8 people shot and injured around the Caribbean Festival. At that time, for example, 2 30-year-olds were arrested on the scene. There are a bunch of ways I could go at this piece of the conversation, but there are 2 things I really want to understand from you. The first is we also have lower crime statistics in the city in a number of areas. For example, in 2022, roughly 25% decrease in violent sexual crimes and more than 15% drop in residential burglary, according to BPD statistics. Are we, in your mind, a violent city?
So it's all relative. So because if you don't, and I was, if you are a victim of any kind of violent crime or you know someone or your family members are, statistics don't mean anything at all. If we were, statistically speaking, the least violent city in the world, if you're a victim of that, it's not going to feel that way to you. And so that being said, statistically speaking, we're not a violent city. In comparison to certainly other cities our size, our crime rate is very low. And in comparison to our own statistics from year to year, it's getting lower each year. If you just look at the number of shootings we have, I think we are, somewhere around, certainly around 10% less than we were last year, including the incident that you just described. And so, each year, our crime statistics are actually getting better. We're working very hard. We're partnering with a lot of people to try to keep people safe. But the reality is that, with every, lowering of our crime stats, it seems almost heightened every time we have something that has occurred. So I liken it to this. If we reported out every day that, zero incidents, boy, people would be pretty bored. You keep saying that. But it seems like all you people hear at the end, when it does, something does happen. We have many days when we aren't having incidents of crime. But in certain neighborhoods, it is far more likely to happen than in other neighborhoods. And in those communities, they're saturated. They feel saturated because it seems as though crime has always happened in those neighborhoods. And they're right in a sense that you know, even some of the studies we've done traditionally, certain areas have been certainly more commonplace for, you know, shootings or certainly violent crime. But the fact is, it's a lot lower than it's ever been in the, you know, probably since we kept real statistics on it in the city of Boston. And so how do you have that conversation where, yes, it still occurs, but the fact is it's nowhere near the rate of where it was. It's near the rate where years ago we said it was a Boston miracle, right? We are at that, if not lower than that crime rate right now, but no one's calling it the miracle. We're saying it's a state of emergency, according to some.
I hear you. I do. Mm-hmm. I do hear you. And I think about Isaac Yablo, the senior advisor for community safety, who says, listen, I'm data driven. We have, you know, we have a small set of hot people in hot locations. He talks about the fact that actually the vast majority, on average, shooters are around 30 years old, victims are around 30 years old. We need to rewrite this narrative that we have violent youth in our city. We need to go sort of targeted approach towards a small set of shooters. I also, we have in this room often people who say the city is failing us. We feel unsafe. Our kids feel unsafe going to school. People have sued the schools for feeling like their kids aren't protected. So where are we failing, despite the numbers that you've laid out? Yeah. Where are we failing, and what do we need to do better?
Yeah, so I think I started off by, you know, talking about perception and having real conversations about this. One of the things that we're trying to do, I'm trying to put on these what they call community comm stats. Internally in the police department, we come together, you know, almost every other week to look at all the crime stats in our neighborhood as a police department to figure out how are we going to prioritize certain neighborhoods, where we're going to put people to actually prevent crime from happening or address issues that goes on in general with all our resources. We want to bring that to each neighborhood. Where we, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood, each neighborhood is totally different, to believe it or not, in the city. And actually teach and let people understand what's going on in their neighborhood as far as real crime, so they have a good understanding, so they can understand trends and to see if it's bad or not bad. And then actually educate them on what we're doing to try to address it. And then more importantly, get their input on what they think we should be prioritizing so we can address particularly the issues around fear of crime. And so become more of a partner with our residents into how we're addressing certain things so they can actually feel educated on what's going on. Education has a way to addressing fears. You educate the citizens on what's going on, where the issues are. It's easier for them to hold us accountable, you know, on understanding, oh, okay, well, that's fine. Thank you for teaching us. Now, what are you going to do about this? How are we going to fix this? It should empower them in ways in which they can actually help us, you know, keep our community safe, because that is certainly a group activity. It's not just on one segment of the community. And then more importantly, you know, we can stay focused on what the priorities are in each neighborhood, because they might be different from one neighborhood to another. We just talked about, you know, crime stats getting lower and lower, but yet people feel as though they're not safe. Well, that's addressing the fear, and this usually comes from, I don't want to say ignorance, but from lack of knowledge about understanding what goes on, from lack of knowledge about understanding, you know, is our city safe in comparison to other places around that? And then also been working with them on a daily basis. If they don't feel safe about a street and they're working with us, then we can help them feel safe about that street, because they can actually pinpoint or tell us exactly where to be, when to be there. And then we can show them that we're going to be there, and it helps the community feel safer.
Are there any streets that just aren't safe?
I mean, crime can happen almost in any street anywhere in this country if somebody wants to perpetrate it, if they're intended on doing it. Even right in front of the police. I mean, like I said, the event that happened at the Caribbean Festival, at least at Juvet in that morning, there were hundreds of police standing right there. I mean, hundreds of police standing right there, and it still occurred. And so, you know, I can't get in the mind of criminals or whatever it is making them do whatever it is that they're intended on doing, but we can actually partner with people and have a presence to lessen the likelihood of it happening, and more importantly, make people feel safer about their neighborhood knowing that they're partnered with the police to address crime and fear crime.
So we have, because of your schedule, and you've been generous with your time, we have about 30 seconds left. This next year, what's the most important thing to you to accomplish?
Well, that community compstat that I talked about just now, you know, being able to do that where it's actually the BRIC, our intelligence unit, data-driven, where they drive it, which was part of a funding source which just got voted down by city council last week again. Again, addressing, people don't understand what we do and how we do it. I need to do a better job or do the best job we can of making sure people understand what their police department does, how do we go about doing it, and who we can partner with to do it better. And that begins with, you know, community policing, which we've always been a part of, but we need to grow it and make sure that it evolves to today's world.
Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back again.
Oh, absolutely.
We've just finished a conversation with Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox with us now to reflect on it, understand what comes next. WBUR Senior Correspondent Deborah Becker, Boston Globe columnist Adrian Walker, and Andrew Lelling, former U.S. Attorney from Massachusetts. Deb, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Adrian, great to have you.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Lelling, thanks for coming back as well.
Sure, good to be here.
So I do want to start with reactions, and Deb Becker, you're up first.
Well, I think it was interesting to hear how the commissioner explained what's happening at Mass and Cass, and I felt like he did also acknowledge that perhaps he hasn't been as visible as some folks would like, and he may need to go out there and do some explaining about what the police department actually does if he wants to get some of his goals accomplished.
And Adrian Walker, your first reactions on that conversation?
Yeah, I thought much the same. It was interesting to hear him talk about how complicated Mass and Cass is, and also interesting, you know, to hear him talk about sort of the disconnect between the public perception of crime and safety versus the data.
And to you, Andrew Lelling.
I think the commissioner exudes credibility and calm. I think he's perfect for the moment. I think it's hard to be the police chief in a progressive city because you're constantly balancing progressive goals and how to deal with people on the streets with the need to maintain safety on the streets. And I think that was the theme underlying what he talked about today.
So again, we're here with Andrew Lelling, Adrian Walker, Deb Becker, reflecting on the conversation we just had with Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox and sort of diving into the so what of it. So Deb, you know, you brought up Mass and Cass. Adrian, you underscored also the point that, you know, about sort of presenting in the public trust, and Andrew Lelling talking about credibility in this moment. I want to now go through some of the big policy issues and the internal issues that came up in the conversation, and let's move them forward. And let's start with Mass and Cass, since it is a key one and it's been in the news again this week. And again, I'll underscore the president of the Boston City Council, Ed Flynn, joining with some other council members this week, calling on the Boston Public Health Commission basically to declare a state of emergency there to empower the police department to take down these tents and tarps. The commissioner saying here in the station today, there are civil liberties issues at hand. Without that, I'm not going to comment either way, but boy, I sure'd like to get those tents and tarps down. Deb Becker, you know, what's the stickiest wicket in the moment here? And what about this tension between the public health response and the level of crime that we're seeing there?
I think that an ordinance really would protect the city from litigation. That's really what it does, because ultimately I think that if the city wanted those tents removed, they could do it. It's will they do it in a way that makes sure that people's rights are protected? And I think that's the key question here. So I think it is obviously there was violence there last week. There's a lot of violence at Mass and Cass. The situation has only gotten worse. But I think the response can't just be public health versus public safety. It has to be more nuanced than that. And people have to look at who they're dealing with. And it can't just be going in and removing people or arresting people. It has to be looking at the folks who are actually doing criminal criminal activity there because they want to profit and they want to work as predators, really, on some vulnerable folks and those folks who are there because they are vulnerable. And those are two very different things. And so I think a nuanced plan to deal with that situation is really what's called for.
So, Andrew Lelling, I am interested in former U.S. attorney. You know, this has seemed to be a hard one with the tension between making sure to provide services, addressing civil liberties issues. It was striking today when the police commissioner said, you know, we need a search warrant to go into somebody's home. At what point does a tent or a tarp become a domicile, right? You know, and that creates this tough situation. I'm curious from your perspective, is this hard? What makes it hard? What key issues do you think we need to understand?
Yeah, I think this is very hard. I think this kind of situation is a nightmare for a police department in a major city. Looming in the background, I think you have the cautionary tale of cities like San Francisco that appear to have gone too far in one direction in tolerating people being domiciled, as you put it, on the street. I agree with Deb completely. I think the mistake here is taking the black and white approach, either, you know, send in the troops and clear the place out or leave it all there. There's definitely something in the middle. It may involve increased policing in that area in an attempt to discern patterns among those who are there because they're mentally ill, for example, have nowhere else to go, and the people who are there to prey on others or to sell drugs. It's almost like treating Mass and Cass as its own community and engaging in community policing there. I do think the commissioner may be overthinking the domicile question when it comes to searching or moving tents, but that's a different conversation. But I think his focus on it is exactly right. That issue needs to be resolved and not in a heavy-handed way. I think Cox comes into the job with a lot of credibility, but you get the sense the community has something of a wait-and-see approach with him. And I think, you know, sending in a bunch of cops and tactical gear to clear out Mass and Cass probably overall doesn't help him in the long term.
So I'll turn to you next, Adrian Walker of the Boston Globe. And my plan has been to go dealer's choice and let you pick the next subject, whether we move to the youth or to shootings or to internal in the BPD, unless there's more you want to say about Mass and Cass.
Yeah, I want to stay on Mass and Cass just for a second to say this, which is that, yes, it's a nuanced problem, but the frustration I think the public is feeling is that city government just seems paralyzed by it. And they've got to figure out how to get past the paralysis, you know? You sort of see plans come and go and proposals come and go, and yes, they need an ordinance. But in the meantime, nothing's really happening and nothing's getting better.
To what extent, Adrian, do you think the city council is a piece of that? I mean, it does really seem like you've got two factions in the city council, one putting off looking at the ordinance and another saying, okay, well, if that faction is going to put off looking at the ordinance, then we want this another part of the city to do something right now.
Yeah, and that doesn't make any sense. The city council needs to get its act together and get 7 votes for something, you know?
All right, so let's move on from there. And Adrian, I'll stay with you. You pointed out this, you know, the internal issues for the force. We spent a significant chunk of the beginning of that conversation asking and listening to the commissioner talk about his philosophy inside the force, and he shied away from Mayor Wu's pretty assertive use of the concept of reform. He said, listen, if you manage to the policies you already have in place, you'll be good at law enforcement, and you'll have a good reputation. Did you agree with that? And, you know, is reform not the necessary thing, just enforce what's already internal policies on the books?
I do kind of agree with that, and I think this is where Cox's personal credibility really plays into it. I think he has great credibility up and down through the ranks. And I think, you know, the policies they need to effectively run the department are largely there. God knows there need some changes. I'm not saying they don't need some changes, but, you know, I don't think they need sort of an overhaul of policy. I think what they need is effective leadership and direction, and I think he can provide that.
Deb Becker, do you agree?
I do. I think that I think he can provide the leadership. And I think if you look at his past year, one of the key things we have to remember, some of the history here, I think Commissioner Cox has brought stability to a department that really had an awful lot of controversies. And after Willie Gross retired in January of 2021, and former Mayor Walsh appointed Dennis White, who was terminated after 2 days when domestic abuse allegations surfaced. And so then Superintendent Gregory Long was in charge until Commissioner Cox was appointed a year ago. So I think he's brought some stability to the department, and I think that's been helpful.
When you lay it out that way, Deb Becker, it is really quite striking, isn't it?
Right, right. Yeah, there's a history here. So I think he came into a job in a position where he had to sort of steady the ship, if you will, for a while. And I do think he's done a good job doing that.
So, Andrew Lelling, I'll come back to you. One of the other things that we talked about, I asked Commissioner Cox, is Boston a violent city? He emphasized, actually, no. You know, relatively speaking, looking at the stats, although he did acknowledge if you've experienced violence, of course, for you, Boston is a violent city. And I pushed him on safety, and he said people just need to understand that the city is safe. There's a lot to talk about in guns in Massachusetts as well, so I'm interested from your perspective as a former U.S. attorney, what you made of his position on that. You know, we've got about a minute left here.
What I thought was poignant about what he had to say is that if you look at a recent Gallup poll, Boston is perceived as the second safest city in the United States. It is a safe city. Credit that goes to the police department, at least publicly, seemingly zero. And I think that frustrates him. And I think what he understands is that his number one job is improving morale within the department. Law enforcement officers are very sensitive to morale. You want them on the street doing a dirty, occasionally violent job. And I think he understands that keeping the city safe in the long term depends on the department wanting to be out there doing that work. And I think it's right that that's his focus.
All right, we will end it there. Andrew Lelling is the former U.S. attorney from Massachusetts. Deborah Becker is a senior correspondent here at WBUR. And of course, Adrian Walker, columnist for the Boston Globe. Really appreciate the three of you joining us and providing some analysis today. Thank you.